June is over, and with it, Pride Month. Maybe you attended the parade or the festival, but there's something that may have slipped your radar. Queers Divest, an informal group of Utah LGBTQ activists, sent a letter to the Utah Pride Center demanding that it divest from Wells Fargo and Chase Bank and revoke their entries in the Pride Parade, and also to re-examine the center's board appointment practices to address a perceived lack of diversity among its members. After meeting with Pride Center leadership, Queers Divest marched in the parade ahead of the corporate sponsors, including Wells Fargo and Chase Bank. This is In the Hive. I'm Emily Means. Recently, I spoke with Utah Pride Center Executive Director Rob Mulman about his perception of the letter and the situation, and you can find that conversation in the Hive archives. But I wanted to know why the Queers Divest folks chose now to call out Wells Fargo and Chase Bank, and to bring the Pride Center into the conversation. I asked Lauren Wood, a community organizer and a part of the Queers Divest initiative, what prompted the letter?
Why does any movement moment percolate at the moment it does? Yeah. It's a really complicated question. I often think of movements like the underground mycelium of fungus mushrooms, and you only see these little mushrooms on the surface, but there's actually been a lot more work and a lot more interconnected networks that go into the building of those moments that we see. So I think this moment with Chase Bank and Wells Fargo is one mushroom. It's one moment that we're seeing of a pressure campaign that's been put on these banks for quite some time by prison divestment movements, by fossil fuel divestment movements, the climate movement for quite some time now. And it's now manifesting in the LGBTQ community here in Salt Lake City.
Can you talk about some of those specific examples of how Wells Fargo and Chase Bank are harming marginalized communities?
You know, I can speak mainly to the things that I've been closest to. And as a climate justice organizer, it's been really obvious to see the ways that institutions that finance the destruction of our planet are harmful to everyone. It's not just the marginalized communities. The fossil fuel infrastructure projects specifically that have been funded in the millions and billions of dollars by Chase and Wells Fargo, like Dakota Access Pipeline and many others, have forwarded the climate crisis. And it is also most impacting the communities closest to those infrastructure projects, which, again, tend to be communities of color, indigenous communities, and people who white society deems throwaway cultures.
That's why Carl Moore was marching in the parade. We spoke with him, or I spoke with him at the same time I talked with you earlier. Can you see examples of that hitting closer to home here in Utah?
I'd like to just say, I think that Carl is a really great example of someone who came to that march as an ally, as someone who queer people in this community have organized with around Standing Rock and Dakota Access. And even though Dakota Access and Standing Rock isn't in Salt Lake, it definitely brought a movement home here, which had a ripple effect for indigenous sovereignty conversations within the state, within the Bears Ears conversations, and has led to a lot of other great organizing. So, you know, was that directly Wells Fargo and Salt Lake City? No. But the organizing relationships that are happening are intersectional in nature and are hoping to move forward as such.
Well, that kind of leads me into something that was mentioned in the original letter, and that's that most of the letter's authors are white. Why
Sure.
did these white people take it upon themselves to push this issue to the forefront?
I think that's a great question. And I ask myself that question all the time. Why am I, as a white person, trying to insert my voice, which is already easily heard, into these conversations? And the reality is that Salt Lake's a really weird place to organize. I've been doing it for over a decade now. And there's a lack of conversation around these issues. And I think it's largely because a lot of friends of mine who are organizers of color are really tired of having to be the only voice of a few tokenized individuals within the organizing community who have to speak to these issues again and again and again in different forms and settings, because there's a lack of understanding in a in a predominantly and pervasively white culture in the state. And so we felt like it is an important thing to talk about and bring up as white community members, regardless of whether we're directly impacted. We know that there are people in this community who won't even come to the table and have the conversation with Utah Pride Center anymore. Maybe they had in the past and they've just been burned too many times, not just by Pride Center, but by the nonprofit industrial complex or these kind of do-gooder organizations that are trying to do the right thing but are again have
beholden
major blind spots.
Their donors.
Exactly. And it's a structural problem that we're talking about, and we're all impacted by structural inequality regardless of the color of our skin. We're just impacted in different ways. So I feel like my struggle is connected to everyone else's struggle. I just happen to have more access and resources in certain ways, and it's my duty to use as many avenues that I do have access to as possible to leverage my voice for those other individuals in the community, not as a savior, but as someone who's in solidarity with my friends.
If more people of color had been involved in this initiative, and maybe more will be involved, what do you think the request that you sent to the Pride Center would have looked like?
We put this together somewhat last minute, and it was pretty obvious to a number of us who'd been working on divestment initiatives within the climate movement. Hey, these are some really low-hanging fruit targets. These guys are really dirty. They're doing really bad things internationally. It's a great place to start a conversation. And after we put that letter out, people were like, hey, you know, why didn't you target the police? Come on. And why didn't you target, you know, L3, who's another major defense contractor? Like, why aren't you targeting these other, you know, Goldman Sachs, these other problematic institutions? And our answer was, yeah, you're right. We agree. These are also really big issues that our community is going to have to grapple with. And we're not trying to just, you know, wipe the board clean, throw babies out with bathwater, but rather have an honest and complicated conversation in our community about what we do and don't support and who we do and don't include. So my answer to that would be, yeah, it probably would have looked really different depending on who's in the room, but it's not a closed conversation. And honestly, a lot of the conversations we did have with UPC, Utah Pride Center, were talking about next steps and opening up committees and dialogue and decision-making bodies that can actually change how this looks moving forward. So I look at that as being a really cool open invite where we can get more voices at a table potentially.
Well, that's what I was hoping to talk about next, is what this conversation does look like moving forward. And maybe since we have those two demands that were featured, we can kind of pick them apart.
Sure.
Of course, like we said, the Utah Pride Center is a nonprofit. It's tough for nonprofits to fund their services.
Totally.
So what does, what does that look like going forward? Do you expect the Pride Center to completely divest from these corporations or what?
So I think that the ask in the letter was, you know, divest, and specifically we wanted to ask that they not get free PR in these Pride parades. So Pride parades have a long history, and I think initially back in the 20th century, it was one thing to have corporations that were really risking something of their bottom line come out and say, hey, we stand in solidarity with our LGBTQ staff and friends and family. Luckily, in many situations and contexts, maybe not in smaller prides in rural America, but in most contexts, these corporations are not risking much of anything. It's pretty okay to be gay in a corporate PR standpoint these days. So really what we're doing is offering them a free megaphone to get more people to buy into their image and branding. And we're saying, we don't think you deserve that image and branding. So I, as an individual, think Wells Fargo and Chase, and I speak for myself, not Queers Divest, but generally I think we'd say, if you guys want to give them all the money in the world, that seems fine as long as it's coming with actual no strings attached, as long as they're making decisions that are not beholden to you continuing to give that support. And that means not actually showing their logo on everything that you do. I don't think that a lot of donors like to do that without any name recognition, but that is ideally what we're asking. There's been conversations thrown around trying to see, you know, if we can find local credit unions who'd be willing to match their donations dollar for dollar. I haven't ever seen what the numbers are, and maybe I'm not giving Wells Fargo and Chase enough credit, but I kind of think they're doing this more for the PR than really giving hundreds of thousands of dollars to our intrepid local queer organizations. I'd love to be wrong on that.
Well, then looking at the part that mentions the board, is there anything that you would recommend the Pride Center do to, I don't know, increase representation on that board?
You know, I think that especially when you target a board, that's real people in your community, and those real people have real feelings, and I hope that we didn't burn any significant bridges, because I do think there's a lot of amazing individuals that do spend their time and their free volunteer energy volunteering on the board. But that being said, I think that what we are asking for is earnest efforts to open up a new kind of conversation on that board from perspectives that are probably missing. And sometimes that might be people who don't have really deep pockets. Maybe you need a mixture of both working and non-working. I think sometimes there's an understanding that, you know, if we have percentage representation of individuals on a board that reflect the individuals in our community, we're doing good, right? And all in all, like you said, you know, Utah Pride Center isn't just cis straight white men, or it's at least not cis white men entirely, of course. But what we need to talk about, and I think the paradigm shift, is equity, not equality. We need to have individuals who see the need to prioritize, not just give equal say, but prioritize and center the most marginalized communities, because they have a lot further to come as far as rights are concerned. So we shouldn't just have one tokenized individual necessarily, but ideally a much more, you know, swing the pendulum a little bit further towards focusing on those marginalized communities.
Do you have a meeting planned with the Pride Center leadership yet?
No. I sent an email to Rob, just again thanking him and their, you know, I mean, honestly, he's opened up a really important conversation in this community, and I think it was brave. I think it was a really brave thing to do with someone who's new to that organization, so I commend him. And I'm excited to continue in conversations with him and the organization. And I think I could say the same for the rest of Queers Divest. There isn't a specific meeting set, but like I said, we're going to have a conversation this week, and I'm sure out of that conversation, as with any good organizing meeting, will be some good next steps. So stay tuned for sure.
Okay, Lauren Wood, part of Queers Divest, thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
Wood mentioned that they hope this could aid an intersectional movement for the LGBTQ community in Utah. But what does that even mean? Intersectional. It's something of a social justice buzzword lately, but it refers to the different identities you hold. Your race, your gender, your age, your socioeconomic status, and how people perceive them.
So I always give the example, yeah, I'm a woman, but I'm a Japanese-American woman. And I'm not just a Japanese-American woman, I'm an older Japanese-American woman. And that all, it impacts how I navigate in this society that's predominantly white, that values youth. And then I talk about also, I'm a hetero Japanese-American woman, but I'm also a hetero Japanese-American woman that got married, which in society's mind is a good thing. Not only that, I have children, another good thing. Not only that, I have grandchildren, another good thing. I did everything a woman is supposed to do, right? And so it's this intersection of how you navigate in society. What do they notice first about you? What do they think is the most important identity for them about you?
This is Irene Ota from the University of Utah's College of Social Work. She says these perceptions are not always representative of your actual experiences. They're assumptions based on what people think they know about you.
It's how society indoctrinates people into understanding those identities, not how I understand my identity, right? But how society says, this is what this identity is like. And that makes the intersections of identities even more difficult in navigating, because society said, well, this is what it means to be a Japanese woman in America, when that's not my definition or even my experience of what that means. And that's that intersection of how did I grow up? How did you grow up, right? So my Japanese American friend, who's my same age, she's third generation. I'm first generation. My parents, we immigrated here. They didn't speak English. Her parents were interned. Let's understand what it means to be a Japanese American person or woman in Salt Lake City, Utah is very different.
It doesn't just apply to individuals, though, but groups and movements as wholes. For example, the LGBTQ community. It's an umbrella term to help describe a person's gender identity or sexual orientation outside of being straight or cisgender, but still, a variety of people with a variety of experiences are included within it. Ella Blanchard from the University of Utah's LGBT Resource Center says we have to be wary of referring to it as one community.
What's really important, so when we use words like community or leaders, we want to avoid speaking in a monolith. So it's not one community. How we define what is the LGBT community would vary a great deal from person to person, to be terribly honest. So when I think about our historical touch points, I mean, a lot of people would talk about Stonewall as a good example. So that was almost 50 years ago now, but it was led by queer and trans folks of color. It was led by folks who weren't really welcome in some of the other gay bars that didn't pass for straight, that didn't pass for cisgender, meaning not transgender, that didn't pass for capitalists or for people who could hold down a job. I mean, it was the people who were on the outside sometimes of what I would call white, cis, gay community.
And there's no one defining issue for them either.
You can be absolutely excited about the marriage decision, or you could not. And that also doesn't mean that you don't have other things going on in your life. For me, if I were to take a priority list of things that were affecting my life, and this even goes back to before marriage passed, to me, marriage wouldn't have even been in the top five. And working with the students I work with and the community that I work in, marriage was never in that top five. I mean, we're talking about a problem that really only affects a very wealthy few that are worried about estate taxes and how to figure out their tax rate and their bracket. Whereas a lot of the people I'm talking with and that I'm a part of worried about where to live, where to sleep. Honestly, it comes down to police brutality a lot of times. When we talk about a feeling of safety, adding police hasn't made a lot of people felt safe.
So how do you organize a movement, a conversation even, that at least attempts to address the needs and experiences of such a diverse group of people? Blanchard says,
don't be a jerk.
Ota elaborates.
You have to talk to the people who you want for any reason why you want to include them, or you want to feel like, no, you're part of this community. Well, how? What makes you feel part of this community? How can we support you in that? Instead of saying, well, this is what we're doing and you should feel included, right, when you don't. With that whole thing about divesting,
Queers
is that
divest,
right?
Yeah.
Divesting from Wells Fargo, Chase, okay, why? Can we just talk about why? What does that mean to people to do that? What does it mean if you don't do it? Let's have a chat. Let's talk about what that means to people, and let's validate and have respect for their understanding, their experiences. I mean, it's called feminist standpoint theory, right? So
well, I think also, I mean, like, I think we're an example of this in a microcosm, Irene. I mean, I think about our relationship over the years, and I remember with great shame some mistakes I've made along the way around my whiteness, or, you know. And I know you've made mistakes along the way too, right? And so what does it mean to build community with flawed people as a flawed person? And so if we're talking about next steps for folks, especially like speaking to my white folks that might be listening, is, you know, have some vulnerability. Just acknowledge that you are not right. I mean, that's really hard for white people to do. I wish it was not that hard, but it's important to go into a conversation, to go into a relationship, however kind of relationship it is, if it's, you know, friends, colleagues, lovers, whatever it is, going into that relationship knowing that you're not right and listening.
Have some humility.
Yeah, meeting people in that vulnerability of saying, you're right, I'm, you know, that was messed up, and I'm sorry, and not throwing away another person just because they've made a mistake. It's a really hard balancing act sometimes, having a boundary, which is important, having a boundary that keeps you alive and not having people that are constantly causing violence in your life. But you can't have such a rigid boundary that you're not willing to trust in anyone.
That was Ella Blanchard from the LGBT Resource Center and Irene Ota from the College of Social Work at the University of Utah. This year is the third anniversary of the Supreme Court ruling legalizing marriage equality in the United States. But before the Obergefell decision, Another case, Kitchen v. Herbert, rocked Utah by challenging Utah Constitutional Amendment 3, which defined marriage as being exclusively between a man and a woman. Derek Kitchen and his partner Moody Speedy were the very visible faces of the lawsuit, which began in 2013. But a new documentary, Church and State, takes a behind-the-scenes look at the whole process. I spoke with co-director Holly Tuckett about the film.
Our movie looks at the case from the inside. We followed the plaintiffs, the lawyers, and the little-known activist named Mark Lawrence and his organization, Restore Our Humanity, who actually are responsible for the case in the first place. And a lot of people don't know that. And so our film really kind of re-educates people on the accurate history of the case here in Utah. And then we also give kind of a history lesson, if you will, and a lesson in Mormon doctrine, you know. So we look at church history, we look at the doctrine itself and why it was so unusual that the case happened here and that Amendment 3 was overturned, because the Mormon Church had inserted themselves in the fight against gay marriage from the beginning. And I don't think a lot of people understand. I mean, you know, Prop 8, you know, was definitely where it reared its ugly head for the church. But I don't really think that people understand the philosophical reasons and the doctrinal reasons why it was so important for the church to be involved in Prop 8 and to kind of make a case from early on, back in the Hawaii cases, actually, when they really started getting involved, which was in the early 90s, you know. That's when the church really, really, you know, was like, no, we cannot let gay people get married.
Well, I want to talk about the influence of the church in a minute, but you mentioned activist Mark Lawrence, and you know he's not the face of this lawsuit. So nope. Why were you compelled to tell his story?
I say this in my director's statement, and I need to share that with you so that you have it. But the first line is you know, the Kitchen case starts with regret for me. Church and State starts with regret, because in April of 2013, Mark Lawrence approached myself and another producing partner that I was, you know, working with on other films, and asked us to do a documentary about this case that he was launching against.
Back when it started.
And he was like, we just barely have secured our lawyer, Peggy Tomsick with Magleby and Greenwood. And, you know, I started asking questions, and frankly, being gay and Mormon background and living here most of my life, was like, there's no way he's going to succeed. This isn't going to happen. And not only is it going to happen, there's no way he's going to be able to raise the money. He's not connected enough. And I just wasn't in a financial position at the time to take a journey with somebody who I wasn't sure was going to succeed. And so I turned him down. And then in January of 2014, of course, I like everybody else, on December 20th, sitting at my desk doing some editing on a project that was due, and all of a sudden my producing partner comes running out of the office, and he was like, he succeeded, he did it. And I was like, what? Who did what? You know? And he's like, open your browser. And we started looking at, you know, images of people getting married on December 20th.
You just didn't expect it to ever happen.
Nope, didn't expect it. And no one expected it, you know? And no one believed that Mark could do it. And so it was very important to me that everyone knew who he was, because had he not had the grit and the balls to take on the state and say no and be that person, we wouldn't even know who Derek and Moody were, let alone have gay marriage legal in Utah. It might have happened eventually, and it might have happened via some other case, bringing it to the United States. But it wouldn't have happened here for the state of Utah by a team from the state of Utah. And so it was really, really important to me that his story be told. Because I started asking people after we had finished filming, and I just relayed this story of nobody knew who he was. No, you know, I would say, do you know who Mark Lawrence is? And they'd be like, who's Mark Lawrence? And I was sitting, we had filmed Derek and Moody's wedding, and we were sitting with his family at the reception. And I had taken a break and, you know, had the camera in my lap, and this cute little grandma, Derek's grandma, sitting next to me, turned to me and said, well, you've been following this, you know, you're doing the documentary. She's like, what made Derek want to sue the state of Utah? And I smiled and I said, you know, I'm not sure. It was at that moment that I knew we had to tell Mark's story, because otherwise he literally would have been a forgotten hero.
Well, like you said, he took on the state, but in Utah, when you take on the state, you also take on the church, essentially. And, you know, recently the Supreme Court ruled on another LGBTQ-related case, the Masterpiece Cake Shop versus the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And the church, they definitely involved themselves in this one, too. They signed on to a friend of the court brief. Maybe you can kind of explain the depth of the church's involvement and influence in politics and culture as explored by your film.
Yeah. So 95% of the legislature here is Mormon. But yet, if you look at the makeup of the Salt Lake Valley, 60% identifies as not Mormon. So the representation, at least if you look at just the Salt Lake Valley, the most populous area of the state, the majority does not have a represented voice on Capitol Hill. And that's weird to me. And Steve Urquhart in our movie, he used to be a senator.
Right, St. George.
From St. George. Started out a total staunch conservative. I believe one of my friends, Melissa Byrd, who used to be with Equality Utah, and she was with Planned Parenthood Action Council, wrote a lot of great, you know, helped craft some bills and things like that, convinced Steve that he needed to hear her out long ago. And I think, you know, the things that she had to say to him, and I don't even know what those were, but they became really good friends up on the Hill when she was lobbying there. And he kind of changed. He softened. He softened and he started to listen to the other side. And he started to see that, yes, there were some inequalities and somebody needed to champion some of those issues. And he did that. He became that champion. And in our film, you know, he had since left the legislature, so he felt like he could speak a little more freely. Mm-hmm. And he actually had done, I think it was either an op-ed or he had said something on Facebook, and he basically called out that, you know, yes, legislators are courted by the church, and nothing happens on the Hill without some sort of discussion from the church. And is that fair? Is that right? I mean, we're supposed to have a separation of church and state. And so how, you know, if legislators are being whispered, you know, whether it be the higher ups within the church or representation from the church or whatever it might be, you know, they lobby on the Hill, whether they should or not. They do lobby there. So I think our film explains the complicated place that is Utah and how involved the church has become, especially when it comes to LGBTQ people.
That's Holly Tuckett, co-director of the documentary film Church and State. Thanks to the KCPW team for their support of this show, as well as to Andrew Shaw, who produced the show's theme music. And thank you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of In the Hive at kcpw.org, including part one of this conversation with Utah Pride Center director Rob Mulman. Up next is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Emily Means. Thanks for listening.